50 or 60 polar bear and hundreds of seals basking in the short southeasterly sunlight of a clear, calm day. Had been in the area for a total of 5 days, nearly all perfect weather, and I made an observation that the ice pans had been severely broken up into sections of 700 or 800 feet in diameter. Now, this is not conductive to landing a loaded 180 Cessna on retractable skis. It's about half long enough. Some of the ice is slippery. And we considered this problem since, in addition to aerial photos, the party of photographers would like very much to land on the ice and to take with their various lenses pictures of seals and whales, polar bears from the ice. My suggestion was that we land at Point Hope and engage number one, some of the native hunters, such as John Octolic, who had run the native store and was a part-time hunter, or some of the other dog team operators of Point Hope, to take the photographers out via dog team. It would be scenic, and with the knowledge of the area, it would be more or less safe also. So it was agreed that they should, number one, do the dog team photographic tour from the ice, the open ice, the leads, and to go on seal hunts and to fish for tom cod and sheafish and various other activities the Eskimos carry on throughout that type of the season. And also, at this particular time, there were quite a few polar bear hunting crews moving around in the area, up and down the coast. Some of them were stationed out of Point Hope. So I met several of my old acquaintances, and it was agreed that they should take my party in smaller aircraft to the areas that we'd already visited, that we knew was abounded with polar bears and other sea life. And then with a smaller aircraft, they would be able to negotiate the broken ice pan. The passengers and all their gear were offloaded at Point Hope, and I continued in a southbound, southwesterly direction. And and the forecast of the weather was ominous. Incoming storms, 5 or 6 days of good weather on the north coast, and it's almost certainly followed by at least an equal amount of time of bad weather. I continued about 200 miles south of Point Hope. I checked in and out of Kotzebue, refuel there, and immediately departed for Galena, which would be several hundred more miles to the south. Now, this was a rapidly moving warm front. It was an overrunning warm front, and it was moving at considerable speed at altitude, probably in excess of 100 miles an hour. The ground wind at the time was prevailing westerly. Over the winds aloft were from the southwesterly direction, and I ran into heavy turbulence, and so 150 miles south of Kosciuszko, I decided to either make a landfall at Nome or at Moses Point. And within 30 minutes, I ran into lion squalls, heavy snow, ice, and I continued and made a successful landing in a very heavy snowstorm at Moses Point. And I checked the weather, and sure enough, there was a tremendous storm moving in, and it had moved in very swiftly. So I stayed for 2 days and two nights at Moses Point, awaiting the storm to blow itself out. On the third morning, clearing conditions prevailed, and I departed for McGrath. The forecast was for improving conditions. There was some storm action, however, between Moses Point and McGrath. And McGrath lies about 300 miles, anyway, 250 miles to the south, southeast of Moses Point, and about 200 miles on course. I again encountered tremendous turbulence, icing conditions, and a very nervous air condition, and light, heavy, wet, sticking snow. I mean, snowflakes of large diameter, but they were wet. And they stuck on the aircraft. And so I made a landing at the old mining village of Flat. And at Flat, I refueled, topped the tanks off, and passed the time of day with some of the old-timers of the area. And there was a high overcast at the time, 5,000-6,000 foot overcast. And after an hour's wait and refueling, I decided that I would take off for McGrath, the old mining village of Flat. Flat is approximately 100 miles from McGrath, and so I departed Flat, the old mining village, for McGrath. And within 30 minutes, I was into another tremendous storm. And I tried to return to Flat, which was impossible. And I tried to proceed to McGrath, which was impossible. And I flew for 3 hours and 30 minutes, looking for a landing possibility. At this point, I'm over the Von Frank Mountains. They go 5,000-6,000 feet in height. They're very rugged mountains. There's very few places to make a successful landing in this area. And finally, as I flew along, the aircraft picked up tremendous amounts of ice on the wings. The windshield iced over. There was one small area of the windshield which was cleared by the constant heat of the windshield heater. However, this location was not always clear either. My objective now was to land, and after looking over 5 or 6 landing possibilities, either the location would fade from view, or I would make a turn and try to evaluate the area, and upon overflying the area again, I would lose it in a heavy storm with obscured visibility, or I just couldn't reorient the plane to locate an area of a landing possibility that looked promising. At any rate, I Finally, got a glimpse of a place on the top of a mountain, and it was either land there or continue, and I was very low on gas, so I landed. The landing was successful, and immediately all quadrants of the horizon were completely blanketed by snowfall at the rate of 1 foot every 2 hours. I had called McGrath on my HF radio and advised them. Northern Consolidated Airlines maintains a powerful HF radio. McGrath advised them of my predicament. The aircraft's covered with ice. I'm not sure of my position, and I'm almost out of gas, and I've made a successful landing. And I had been flying for more than 3 hours, and in devious various directions, endeavoring to find a landing location to safely park the aircraft. So I was not sure of my position. At any rate, the operator, Huff was his name, at McGrath for Northern Consolidated, stood by to make sure I had completed the landing successfully, and I estimated I was in the Von Frank Mountains at a 5,000 foot elevation. So with heavy snow, my project for the night was to secure the airplane in the tremendous winds, which was blowing the blizzard into the area, and I cut some gnarled spruce trees and buried them deep in the snowbanks underneath the wings in several locations, and was able to tie the aircraft down in this manner. Also, I laid out a runway which was 2,000 feet long, and I spent all my time for the next 5 days packing this runway for the great eventuality of time when the storm would stop. 5 days later, the storm did stop. During that time that I had been there, I dug the plane completely out 3 different times. It has snowed a depth of 9 feet, and the world was one big tremendous pile of snow. Also, the scrub spruce, while not too abundant, was available, and I had made 3 huge piers of swamp spruce. Now, these piers were to act as signal fires. I had in my aircraft load in my survival gear a brand new 5-gallon can of Blazo, which is a pressure plant's fuel. I used it also for the engine heater, and also my plan was if I heard an aircraft in the area, I would touch off the 3 huge piles of gnarled swamp spruce and make 3 signal fires, which is the international distress signal. My radio, I might say, was functional, but my battery was becoming run down, so my procedure was to run the engine a while I operated the radio. And when the aircraft stopped, it was at a steep angle, pointed uphill, and while transmitting a message on the third day to McGrath, I noticed that the engine was faltering and trying to quit. My deduction was that since the nose of the aircraft was so high and the tail was so low, why the fuel was not properly running into the carburetor. So I cribbed up the tail. I took the plane in a level attitude by crimping up with pieces of swamp spruce log under the tail section of the aircraft. This is quite a job. And also on the fourth day, the weather was intermittent and clearing. It looked like the forest storm would finally blow through, so I made this radio contact with the McGrath, and they told me that the Air Force was flying a grid pattern of the whole area there to see if they could locate me more precisely with their direction finders. Also, the main stations in Kodiak and Anchorage, Fairbanks and Barrow were getting a fix on my position. Now, many of the plane has gone down in the great areas of Alaska with a fading radio transmission, and in some cases the aircraft has never been heard from again and never found. I had provisions for about 30 days and an excellent cold weather, a survival collection of gear in the plane, so I thought that in the event that I was not located, I could probably last for about 6 weeks. In between the events, I was of course busy snowshoeing down this 2,000 foot strip on the very steep side of one of the Von Frank Mountains, in preparation of course for the time when the weather did break out. I could affect the takeoff. Of course, what I needed was fuel. I advised McGrath that I needed 20 gallons of 80-87 aviation fuel for my aircraft. And they rogered the request and said that when the weather broke, hopefully they could deliver the fuel. So on the fifth day, the weather improved and I heard a heavy transport aircraft. It was a military C-54, and it was homing in on my fading radio signal. And would you believe, as it came within 20 miles of my location, my radio quit completely. However, I still had the signal fires. The aircraft proceeded within 5 miles of my position. And I rushed around with my 5 gallons of Blazo appliance fuel and poured liberal quantity of the fuel on each of the three huge piles of snarled swamp spruce, which was to be my signal fires. And one after the other, I lighted the would-be signal fires, and at this point, the temperature had dropped to 40 below zero, and the fuel would burn off from the tinder, but the tinder would not ignite. So, this was a disparaging development. At any rate, in spite of the fact that my radio quit, and in spite of the fact that that signal fires did not work, the C-54 transport overheaded me through the breaks in the fog, and they found my location okay, and disappeared into the overcast after circling my location for three different orbits. They pulled up into the overcast. At any rate, I had requested 20 gallons of 8087 fuel, and then from far in the distance I heard the heavy transport making another approach. And this time, there were three parachutes with airdrop fuel parachutes came floating down to within close proximity of the aircraft, and I rushed over, and the first two cans I opened, and to my shock, the cans contained dirty bilge water, no gas. So likewise, on the next two parachute loads, the 2 5-gallon jerry cans contained dirty bilge water. And then the aircraft transport disappeared, and it came in from a different direction, and this time he dropped 30 gallons of 8087 aircraft gasoline. And I might say that I have had a long association with the Air Force, and I helped in numerous rescues of other aircraft, and I also was instrumental in locating 5 military disasters, which I found in inclement weather most of the time. And we had worked closely together for years, and some of my friends in the transport aircraft thought it'd be a real joke if they dropped me the water prior to dropping the gas, because here I was on the receiving end of the line instead of on the helping end. The time of the fuel drop was in the late afternoon, and I elected to hold fast in view of the failing light to try an early morning takeoff the next day. I was busily cleaning the frost off the aircraft, and in the meanwhile I had shammied the fuel that had been dropped, and I was about ready to effect a turnaround, which is quite a job alone in the 180 on the snow with the skis, of course, when one of my friends, Sam Parent from Red Devil Mine, who had been searching and searching in the area, had also located my position, and he dropped in to give me a hand to turn the aircraft around, and he was a very welcome sight. I affected to take off and went via McGrath to Talkeetna, and this is one instance where it evolved that I had been on both sides of the fence. In this case, I was the one that needed the help. It's interesting to talk to Colonel Rogers, who was flying an F-104, a good pattern of that whole interior area, to hopefully locate me, my location by sound. I had, this was on the third day, when the flight of F-102s were doing the grid pattern in the area. They knew every second exactly where they were at, and I'd been instructed by Mr. Huff of Northern Consolidated in McGrath to, at the first sound of their engines, to check in on the radio. At this time, I still had some power in the battery and was able to do so. So when I first heard the jets, they were to the far southwest, and I'd estimate possibly 50 or 75 miles to the southwest. And this confirmed an automatic direction finding fix from Fairbanks, Barrow, and Kodiak Island, and I was in a very confined given area of the Von Frank Mountains. There was quite a few interesting sidelights. One is that on the particular frequency used, which is 3411. This is the channel that all the interior airways aircraft use, and it's a very busy aircraft channel. And while I was making contact with the F-102s and also getting a direction finding fix from the various stations around the country, someone came out on the radio in a loud and clear voice and said, "Well, please everybody shut up while we see if we can get this guy in 9339 Tango direction finder fixed." So there was not a peep for the next half hour on a very busy aircraft channel of 3411. And there's been many a plane disappear without a trace. It wasn't lucky enough to have a powerful HF radio to reach out across the miles and to contact someone and give them a clue as to the location and the identity of the aircraft that was down or going down. There's been some skin of the teeth recoveries, and there's been many disasters and many aircraft found years later in locations far away from the estimate of the location when the aircraft had got out a message and given a location. So there's in this roadless area, the way to travel it in the summer, of course, is occasional by boat, and in the wintertime by dog team. But primarily, since there are no roads on the interior Alaska, with the exception of a very few late roads, there's a large part, the Yukon area and the North Coast, that have a very nominal road system. So everything is flown, and if anyone is in trouble or runs into mechanical or weather problems or structural problems while landing at some of the improvised sandbars and airfields, the people turn out, the other pilots of the area and the people on the ground do their best to retrieve and to help out the party that's in the problem area. And during 1941, I was on a survey crew in the McGrath area, and this was for the old Searfield Aeronautics Authority. We were laying out the fields of Ruby and McGrath and Farewell, a flight of six P-36s, the latest fighter aircraft that the Army Air Force had at the time, were in a tremendous weather problem. They had flown on a maneuver from Anchorage to Nome, and on the return trip, they were unfortunate enough to be involved in a solid blanket a snowstorm that covered hundreds of miles in all directions. Furthermore, it was of considerable depth, 20,000 feet thick and 400 or 500 miles square, and they should be caught right in the middle of this tremendous storm. This is also in the area of the Von Frank Mountains. The final resolve was, with visibilities in the 00 areas all throughout the whole interior of the Kuskokwim and the Yukon, the six P-36 fighter aircraft homed in on McGrath. They flew on their leader, wingtip to wingtip, and they made many range approach passes at McGrath. Still unable to see McGrath at this time. They had a short 2,500 foot airstrip, which was suitable in the daytime, but not suitable for a blind landing in a fire. The final end result was that all six fighter planes landed in a swamp about 10 miles north of McGrath and put all six P-36 fighters, the hottest fighter in the air at that time, out of commission in one fell swoop. And these are some of the problems that affect not only the military aircraft, but any type of an aircraft that flies and competes with the weather and the elements and winds aloft in interior Alaska. The crews of the six fighter aircraft had given an approximate position, and immediately the dog teams and the trappers of the area set out in hot pursuit, and within 2 days the six fighter aircraft were located, and the crews were recovered. Actually, there was a tremendous press, and the aircraft, as soon as the weather was flyable, were also out looking for the lost Army Air Force. When the road gangs from the old Alaska Railroad crews came to Talkeetna, their idea of a good time was something to drink, something to chase after, and a few friendly skirmishes, which usually ended up in a knife fight. Now this brought complications on one particular foggy night. The party was in progress. The social season was going full bore down at the Bucket of Blood. It was named on this particular night because of a knife fight between three Mexican nationals who had a few differences to settle. And settle it they did right in the middle of the barroom floor. Now normally, on friendly knife fights, you hold the knife in such a manner that only an inch or so of the blade beyond your thumb would protrude from the end of your hand grip. However, as the knife play progressed, the knives were held by their handles, and since they were very vicious, long-bladed weapons, injury resulted. In this particular case, the three of the railroad workers began what appeared to be a friendly bannering type El Toro the Bull knife play, and it wound up with three badly knifed victims lying around bleeding on the bar floor. I was called upon to take the three victims to the hospital in hopes of saving their lives. And there's a great commotion as 100 or more of their compadres were trying to wrap their wounds up and wishing them well. And I took one look at the weather. I checked the anchorage weather, and it was below my minimums considerably. It was heavy fog and very poor instrument minimum weather, and the old 10th Rescue was duly notified, and they turned down the whole project in view of the bad weather. And the chief pilot for the old Civil Aeronautics Authority was notified. His name is Jack Gefford. He remains to this day as chief pilot of the now Federal Aviation Administration, the old descendant, that is, of the old Civil Aeronautics Authority. Now, Jack Gefford was an unusual talent. He laid out all the main fields of Alaska, including all of the instrument approaches, in particular Talkeetna. So he took it upon himself to pick out a choice co-pilot, and they boarded the DC-3 and mint julep condition, and they proceeded north to pick up the three victims. Now, what they had was the information that there were three badly injured men. It didn't give any particulars that they were three Mexican nationals, had been in a friendly knife fight that had turned into the real thing. It just, the message just requested emergency evacuation. So he bored through the black night and the fog, and finally, after his seventh instrument approach on the 4,000 foot strip at Talkeetna, he made a very precarious landing. However, it was safe, and as he offloaded the DC-3, he and the co-pilot was astounded to see about 150 drunken Mexican National Railroad workers swarming around the communications buildings, and their objectives was, of course, to wish their fallen friends well, but mainly to send teletype messages to their loved sweethearts in wives and families in Mexico over the FACA teletype. They greatly interfered with the weather observations of the operator on duty. And they, of course, wanted to also send money orders to Mexico and to various other places in California, which was not possible on the old CAA communications teletype. But they were unable to speak English, and the operator was unable to speak Mexican and Spanish, so communication building was one vast pandemonium. The four victims were lying on the floor in pools, great pools of blood, and it made the footing quite slippery. And after having made seven heroic attempts to land, and then to be confronted by such a sight of a commotion in progress at the Talkeetna communications building, the chief pilot of the old Civil Aeronautics Authority nearly boarded the aircraft and flew back to Anchorage empty. However, he was persuaded upon to load the three injured victims aboard, and two out of three made it to the hospital. The third died en route. But this is typical of some of the tales and some of the confrontations that have taken place in Alaska. The Fairview Inn has seen many owners, the crafty, the shrewd, and simple type business people that would like to just run a friendly meeting place for the old timers, the prospectors, and the itinerant hunters and fishermen, and enjoy the social season of Talkeetna. Morrison was one of the many owners, and he also not only owned the Fairview Inn, but he also became owner of the Bucket of Blood. The location of the encounter mentioned of the Mexican nationals in their friendly Saturday evening get-together and the ensuing knife fight that later took place. Actually, Morrison was a well-to-do Honolulu deep-sea fisherman, and he arrived in Alaska quite by accident. He came to Anchorage at the request of a friend. The friend was in trouble with the federal government for running a place of illegal gambling, and the friend was nailed down to several years in a sentence that he could not escape, and he had at one time borrowed a considerable sum of money from Morrison, so he wanted to, in his manner, repay this money by giving Morrison a building that was used as laundry and actually fronted a gambling operation in the area of Anchorage. So I first met Morrison as he stood on the sidelines near Merrill Field and watched several fishermen unload two gas boxes full of tremendous rainbow trout caught in the Talkeetna area. And he was more than a little interested on the source and the location that the rainbow trout came from. And I told him that I would take him to the location if he would get his fishing tackle, and I would take him back as a courtesy, since the flight inbound to Anchorage had been paid for by the previous sportsman. So with this strange introduction to Stubb Robert Morrison, the Honolulu deep fisherman, we became acquainted, and he was enthralled with the great possibilities of the old mining village of Talkeetna. He savored the flavor of the salmon drying on the river banks and the native population smoking moose meat, and he liked to hear the howl of the malamutes on the long winter nights, and he liked the esprit de corps among the miners and the various other people of the area. So he decided at once to sell his laundry in Anchorage area and to move immediately to Talkeetna, where he could get down to serious hunting and fishing and see the grand sights of the interior of Alaska and the beautiful mountains and see the fine animals of the area. So as we would fly along en route to some good fishing location or some hunting area, he would say, "Now, what is a better plane than one we have for a float aircraft for landing at high altitude on 5,000-6,000 foot lakes?" And so we would discuss the various types of aircraft, and we'd finally decide that we should buy a particular type most suitable for the job. As the year following year progressed, we had a lineup of 8 aircraft, all specially equipped to do a special job. Some landed on the glaciers, some landed on the lakes, and some were good for landing on very short, unimproved sandbars. Many of the landings in Alaska are off prepared runways, and they're in inaccessible locations. And the game, of course, are back in the areas where they're not easily accessible. So this encourages landing in the various locations that are inaccessible from the ground transportation or from any other method of travel. And so it evolved that we finally had 8 aircraft, all specially equipped, and Morrison's plan was to put a down payment of possibly 30% on the aircraft, and I would get a contract flying on the glaciers or up in the mountains or hauling freight for a construction company, and we would pay the aircraft off in this manner. So During this time, of course, Morrison was slightly involved with running not only the Fairview Inn, which was a bar and a hotel, but also the Bucket of Blood, which is located between the Fairview Inn, the depot, and the Talkeetna River. And there was a lot of activity in the mines. The gold mines of the Cache Creek District were located about 50 miles to the west. The gold mines of the Fairview were located about 65 miles to the west. And there was a steady stream of sunburned tonsils coming through the bar, and there was a considerable amount of activity in the little railroad town of Talkeetna. In addition to relaying the track of the railroad, there was homesteaders seeking land, and there's various surveys, since most of the area had not been surveyed, were in progress, and the economy was stable, and the climate was right, so Morrison was having a ball. Morrison's wife moved to Talkeetna with some reservations. She'd never seen a small mining community full of wild people, such as Talkeetna. She had spent her life in Samoa and in Honolulu. She was a professional ancient Honolulu Polynesian and Samoan dancer. Not only could she dance the old time musical dances, but she could also teach. She had a tremendous gift to teach others these dances. And she'd spent a considerable amount of time as one of the best dancers of the island at the Royal Hawaiian Hotel, where only the best of the island are contacted to perform for the very visiting luminaries and the tourist traffic of the islands. Many times, some of the local population, the young ladies, their grandmothers, and had visited Honolulu, and on these occasions, they are always asked to join in with the old Hawaiian dancing schedule. Now, some of Miss Morrison's students were exceptionally talented, and with a great teacher such as Lena, they could do these dances to perfection. So when some of the local people and the ladies of this area were in the Honolulu islands, they would be invited to dance at luau's, which is a common practice for visitors to the island. And it was always a great shock to the islanders to see someone perform all of the Polynesian numbers with precision and grace. They would then be noticed immediately, and they would be introduced as being from Alaska, and the local talented people would make way for solo numbers, and of course Lena's local Talkeetna students excelled in solo numbers, and it was always a great thing to have one of her past students visiting Honolulu or one of the islands do a solo number. Of course, she would be introduced as from Talkeetna, Alaska, where most people in the South Seas visioned people in this area living in ice houses and in primeval manners, here would come up a solo number with perfection and grace, and due, of course, mainly to the efforts of Mrs. Morrison. In addition to her social activities in Talkeetna, teaching the young ladies and their grandmothers and the very wee tots their Polynesian dancing lessons, Lena was very active in social activities, and such as PTA and all the other social meetings that take place at the various times of the seasons, such as Thanksgiving and Christmas time. Also, the various other outstanding holidays were also noted. And Lena was very generous she was looked upon as a leading member of the whole area. One of her sidelights was that she could shoot a tremendous game of pool. And she always wore, most always, some very fancy rings. There was a 10-carat emerald-cut diamond. There was 10 or 12 carats of cut diamonds in several other rings. And then she had several bracelets, which were her favorites. And she also had a number of beautiful nuggets made into necklaces. On one of the pool playing occasions, she inadvertently took off all of the jewelry because it was in the way when she would shoot pool, and deposited this jewelry of 20-some thousand dollars worth in an old cigar box which held various pool cue tips and other junk from the pool table. Now, years later, the mystery was unraveled as to what became of Lena's 20-odd thousand dollars worth of nuggets and diamonds, which were inadvertently put in this cigar box by the pool table. Years, 16, 18 years later, the pool table was sold. The new owner was collecting the odds and ends and the broken pool cues and the clamps that hold the cue tips to the main cue, when suddenly in the bottom of the box was uncovered the flashing 10-carat emerald-cut diamond, the necklace, the bracelets, and the various nugget pieces of jewelry, which Miss Morrison had taken off so that she might play the game of pool. Up to this time, I might add, since Morrison and I were involved in the high finance of buying aircraft, I was given the dubious honor of having hawked the jewelry to buy new airplanes with. The time of the season is February 28th, 1962. Several photographers had contacted me in regard to North Coast flight of about 10 days duration, starting from Talkeetna, direct Galena, Kotzebue, Point Hope, Point Barrow. And in the area, we would remain a week or so and hopeful to take pictures of polar bears, seals, and a whale or so, and the native villages along the north coast. And the trip proceeded via ski plane, and various native villages en route were landed at, and we RON'd at numerous locations, and the trip progressed into the area of Point Barrow. Fortunately, the weather was favorable, and many seals were of, in abundance on the sea ice in the area of Wainwright. Also, there were quite numerous polar bears had put in an appearance, and I might say that the appearance of polar bear is heralded by the appearance of seals. That is, the thing works in this manner. Usually the northeast wind blows, or prevailing northeasterly wind blows in a high pressure area up on the Barrow coast. And then with the incoming storms from the southwesterly direction, overcasts are lofted in and over the Arctic polar air cell, and these storms originate in the Gulf of Alaska and travel more or less past Bristol Bay and on up the North Coast route, and they're accompanied by heavy winds and heralded by high overcast and ominous cloud formations. All of the Eskimo villages hunt seal throughout the winter and into the month of May and first part of June. They take their dog teams up and down the coast, and they hunt whales with the old-fashioned dart gun, which is a heavy caliber projectile with a timed fuse, and usually the dart gun is handheld. However, in some cases harpoons are manually thrown, and there's a warhead in the tip of the harpoon that in either case goes off within several seconds of impact and stuns the whale. And whether the whale has surfaced between an ice lead or is out in open water or near an ice floe, this is an effective way to slow the whale down with this explosive charge until they're able to secure several other lines on the whale via the harpoon route. And as I say, we had 5 days of flawless, beautiful weather. Actually, the daylight is quite limited in February and March on the north coast, but as the sun peaks over the horizon to the southeast, you have about 2.5 hours up the Point Hope coast there, where you get a slight view of the sun as it dips over the horizon there, and all the sea animals and the various fur animals herald the coming of spring by the lengthening of the daylight hours. And there's a lot of activity out on the ocean ice. There's been a study made on T3, the ice island, and observations made by various polar bear crews and ship captains that haul freight to the northern ice choke ports. The observation is that the ice circulates and usually in a northeasterly manner, and it moves at the rate of about 5 knots every 24 hours, circulating, always circulating towards the North Polar route up in the Ellesmere Land area. And it's quite severely cold, even in March, and then the weather slacks off at the tail end of March, April, and May. Brisk zero temperatures and 10, 20 knot winds from the northeast or the northwest, usually, in the case of good weather. At any rate, we had a considerable amount of success taking aerials of various whales. There's five kinds of seals live in the North Arctic Ocean in the Chukchi Sea. And we'd seen 50 or 60 polar bears on this reconnaissance tour. Most of them were, as I mentioned, in the area of Wainwright. Now, the southwesterly winds had been quite violent several weeks prior and had broken the Arctic ice pack into chunks. Some of the chunks freeze back together again and form new green ice, and when making a landing on the Arctic ice, the choice location is, of course, on an old, ancient, rough piece of ice that has considerable thickness and of a great enough size so that in the event of an ice shift, the aircraft won't be dumped into the Arctic Ocean, which has been the case on several occasions when polar bear hunters land their light aircraft.